What's good, everyone? Welcome to the Post Pudgy Podcast for the week of April 11th, 2010. I'm Shani O from Central New Jersey, but I'm originally from California. I sound like this because I have a cold and I haven't had any tea. No, this is GD, Post Pudgy's proprietor, ringmaster, whatever. Here with you guys from Brooklyn. I'm sitting in for Shani, who is off this week. I'm here with the homie Jamel, PB's policy wunderkind, who is in Charlottesville, Virginia. What's good, man?
Hello.
And also with Monica, PB contributor and associate editor at the American Prospect in DC, who needs to fix her smoke detector, which you'll hear throughout this podcast.
Thank you. Sorry, it's actually unfixable.
Oh yeah, well,
I've given up on it.
Our topics this week are Virginia's decision to celebrate Confederate History Month, the healthcare bill's restoration of abstinence-only education, funding for abstinence-only education, and the unkillable idea of acting white. So Jamel, who is our resident Virginian and Southern apologist, will for Confederate History Month.
In some ways, I am actually a Southern apologist because I really do like the South. And most of my Yankee friends are, oh, yeah, the South sucks. I'm like, no, we're not really that bad. So I'm sure, as you've all heard, because Virginia is currently the laughingstock of the country, our governor, recently elected Governor Bob McDonnell, Republican, announced that April would be Confederate History Month. And in his announcement, he made references to the war for independence that Southerners and Virginians fought. He made reference to the deep concerns shared by Southerners then that all Virginians can share now. But he didn't make mention to slavery, which presumably is the whole reason for why the Civil War was fought. If you're going to nitpick that, please don't, because you're wrong. So Governor McDonald made this announcement. His proclamation did not include any reference to slavery, and almost immediately he was hit by criticism from both within the state, from civil rights leaders, from Democrats, from just, you know, Virginians who were very annoyed with this, and hit criticism from the country at large. I thought it was funny and very depressing for as someone who is a very proud Virginian that the Commonwealth was Confederate History Month was a trending topic on Twitter for the United States. Mm. That's not cool.
Do people in Virginia always call it the Commonwealth?
Yeah, well, I mean, you ought to. I call it the Commonwealth because we are a Commonwealth, but calling it a state works too. So yeah, that's the basic story. McDonald is the first governor since I want to say Jim Gilmore to make this proclamation. Both Tim Kaine, who was governor from 05 to, you know, recently, and Mark Warner, who was governor in the first half of the decade, did not issue this proclamation. But even when Jim Gilmore did, Gilmore included references to slavery and should have denounced slavery within this Declaration of Confederate History Month. Both, and for what it's worth, I don't think it actually means much. You know, the Confederacy was, of all the things in Southern history, right, the Confederacy is sort of the one thing you don't want to celebrate. It's, you know, this rebellion against the national government, mostly for the purpose of maintaining their right to own other human beings for the purpose of slavery. And so, while I understand why a lot of white Southerners don't want to think of their ancestors as being these terrible, reprehensible people, and chances are they weren't. You know, they probably were decent people. Slavery and all that stuff notwithstanding, it's not appropriate, I don't think, to dedicate a month to celebrating what amounts to a treasonous kind of authoritarian government that stood firmly against the ideals of this country.
Right. So who is this gesture aimed toward?
I honestly have no idea. you know, part of me, because, like, right, McDonald, Virginia governors, if you don't know, can only serve a single four-year term, and the reason for that is that they have lots of special powers that most governors don't have, and what would make Virginia governors from unusually powerful. But they can serve one four-year term at a time. They can't serve two consecutive terms. And so, you know, it's not as if McDonald's trying to appeal to his just some base in order to, you know,
get reelected
later on for re-election.
Right.
And, you know, by the time, if McDonald is looking at a Senate seat, Jim Webb comes up for re-election in 2012. And so unless McDonald intends to leave the governorship to run for the Senate, which I really doubt that would happen, you know, that seat will already be either Jim Webb will win it again, or whatever happens, will have already been dealt with. And I was going to say, like, it's very obvious that McDonald wants to be president someday, but I can't see this as being particularly beneficial in a presidential run. This is something that will stick with Bob McDonald for the rest of his political career.
That was my next question, like, whether he was eyeing the White House, but I can't imagine that is the kind of thing that would win anyone over, except for a really, really small, a shrinking part of the Republican base.
Right. So right now, I kind of think, and I don't kind of think, I do think that McDonald really believes that Virginia ought to celebrate Confederate history, in that he really believes that slavery is not the most important issue in question. I think that is the simplest explanation for this. It's not a particularly, it doesn't make him look good. Doesn't say very much anything positive about McDonald as a person, but the other explanations are just seem too convoluted and too unlikely. I mean, Bob McDonald might just be a Confederate sympathizer, and unfortunately, that isn't really anything new in the Republican Party.
I think that's right. As another Southerner as well, I think.
Damn! What the hell?
Well, I think it's like. I think it's also partly like the idea that among white people, white is default problem as well, where it's like, you know, it's like, oh, why shouldn't we celebrate our history? It's just part of our history. And they forget that this history is really ugly for the other part of the population of the state that doesn't look like them. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's also very ugly. And a bunch of people brought this up, I think. Some folks at Lawyers, Guns, and Money brought this up, that it's not the case that every Virginian, every white Virginian in 1861 was for secession. West Virginia was formed entirely because they were a large group of Virginians wanting to remain loyal to the Union. And there were thousands of Virginians, not in West Virginia, who stayed loyal to the Union, fought for the Union, and died for the Union. So it doesn't, you know, race notwithstanding, this doesn't represent all of Virginians. It doesn't represent all of Virginian history.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, do either of you as Southerners feel like there's some kind of spiritual or attitudinal difference between, say, a state acknowledging Confederate History Month and having the stars and bars on their state flag?
I don't think there's much of a difference. I don't know. I struggle to understand. I mean, like, on one hand, like I said, I do kind of get the impulse to want to defend one's ancestors, but I just don't get, you know, why so many white Southerners are so deeply invested in this period of their history.
Everybody, a lot of groups do this, wherein, you know, they have this age of unparalleled glory. And obviously, that was never true. It's never true when people have this great fall mythology that they cling to, but they tend to think of, like, these long gone days as glorious and halcyon and sepia tone, and everyone's step upstanding and all that stuff.
I think that's especially true because the Civil War was a very full stop to that idea of that history. So you did have it wasn't true, but you have this idea of a genteel South in which the South was an economic power as well as a cultural power in some ways. And so that all of that pretty much ended. And also the South was fairly, was purposely shut out for years after that too. So that was the Civil War is where Southern supremacy ended. So it seems totally right that that's where they would focus their energies.
Well, I mean, can you argue that Southern supremacy didn't end there? Because there was this long stretch wherein, like, Southern politics sort of dominated national politics. I mean, you can make the argument that it still does. I mean, that's one of the things that's so remarkable about Obama's presidency, is that, like, the aftermath, the political, like, repercussions of the Civil War and Reconstruction and segregation have, like, played out on, have been, like, major.
Yeah.
No, I would agree with that. I think you can make a really strong case that over the next 100 years, the South remained, because of, like, you know, little quirks in the political system, the South remained a very powerful player in national politics. I mean, the past, Bush was basically a Southerner. Clinton was a Southerner. Carter was a Southerner. And then Johnson.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of that. And also, the South, it gets a lot of a national attention because it's like the national problem child. So it's like a lot of our national energy. It's like the focus of where all these things play out.
Absolutely.
I think some of the premacy that we give to Southern rhetoric, like about politics, I think a little bit of that is like the media largely centered in the Northeast still being like amazed at the oddity of what comes out of the South too.
Jamel, you wrote a post on states' rights and how that has still become like, I mean, that's still like a legitimate, not ideologically legitimate, but it's still rhetorically legitimate thing to fall back on. In polite conversation in like Washington media circles, even though states' rights has always been the kind of the weapon of segregationists, and it's obviously it grew out of the secessionist impulse, right?
Right. I mean, if you like I argued in the post, few people who proclaimed states' rights prior to the Civil War were really all that serious about it. I mean, the Fugitive Slave Act is a tremendous exercise of national power, and Southerners, or rather Southern landowners and plantation owners, were all for it because it was a means to which they could enforce their power. I think someone wrote a post about this during the past week, which is that neither the left or right really takes that kind of rhetoric seriously. Like, conservatives may talk about states' rights, but really they use it insofar that it helps them accomplish their goals, and the liberals do the same thing. My problem more is that, you know, it's that when talking about the Civil War, especially, using states' rights as like something to explain, you know, why the war happened seems, A, you know, it kind of ignores the fact that it was the states, I mean, basically the states wanted their right to own slaves or to maintain the internal slave trade. And B, again, like, it's not as if Confederates were all about, like, foregoing the national government. Like, they did what they did. They did what they could to maintain their control. And that's understandable, but I don't like that even in, like, you know, even in mainstream conversation, I feel like we had a conversation like this over Buzz a while back, that people really do believe that the Civil War, that states' rights were the central issue in the Civil War, and that slavery was an important but almost ancillary concern.
Absolutely. I've been stumping for the race beat, the Pulitzer Prize winning book on the Civil Rights Movement and the role that the press played in the Civil Rights Movement for a couple weeks now. But one of the things that was fascinating to me was how so many Southern newspaper editors, Southern segregationist newspaper editors, really stumped for the idea of states' rights because they felt that there was a way to oppose integration and the full enfranchisement of black folks while keeping some kind of intellectual high ground. You know, they didn't, it was like the mantle they could carry. There was a way they could carry this kind of racist impulse without seeming like the people who were like kicking people in the face on lunch counters and you know, like, and lynching people and stuff like that. Anyway, this is my first awkward segue, so be patient with me, people. Next up is the restoration of funding for abstinence-only education in the healthcare bill, about $250 million worth. Monica, you want to tackle this for us?
Yeah, I think this is mainly interesting because it was one of those things that came after the healthcare bill was already passed and signed into law, and everyone said, oh, what's this abstinence-only funding for? And it's really slipped in by Orrin Hatch, who, of course, is Republican and didn't vote for the healthcare bill. And as far as anyone can tell, this abstinence-only funding amendment did not score any votes for the healthcare bill, so it's not clear why it was left in. Well, I think what it looks like is that just everybody was busy doing other things and didn't focus on this.
And they didn't pay attention to it? It just...
Yeah, I mean, that's what people have kind of been saying, but it allots $50 million annually for the next 5 years, so a total of $250 million for abstinence-only education funds, which were stripped out of Obama's budget last year, and Obama has been focusing on comprehensive sex ed and also teenage pregnancy prevention programs. So it's really antithetical to those other programs that are still going on. And my interest in this really was this program requires the states to match the funds, and states already were not using these funds for abstinence-only education to a large degree because they don't think they work.
Because they don't.
Exactly. So I don't really think it's going to make big waves, and it's possible a lot of the money could just sit there. But it was interesting because it was only a couple months ago that the study came out from... it was 6th and 7th grade African-American girls in northeastern cities who had been broken up into different groups. And the group that delayed sex the longest was the group that was in the abstinence-only education group. And so everyone was like, oh, abstinence-only education could still work. But, you know, I kind of thought people had never really dug into that study a lot. So
it wasn't. I was always in the person that abstinence education kept kids from having sex for a longer period of time, which may or may not be, I mean, you could argue that's a pretty good thing. Like, they put off the actual age of sexual initiation, like 2 years or something, right? But when they do start having sex, they end up, because they've only had abstinence-only education, that they don't use condoms, they use birth control, they had relatively unsafe sex. So, I mean, I guess we could argue that the difference between a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old having sex is not a small thing.
Yeah, for these girls, I think it would be the difference between like a 12 and a 13-year-old girl having sex,
right,
and an older teenager having sex. And I'm sure that is a good thing, but like you said, there's really no clue that girls who have abstinence-only education, or boys for that matter, there's no hint that they actually are more successful later on at preventing STIs or teenage pregnancy, which you would think the point of not having sex would be, is to avoid those things. And so, yeah, there have been studies before, and groups that had abstinence-only education could possibly delay sex for longer, but sometimes they felt worse about having sex, and so they didn't want to admit it, or they didn't want to talk to anybody about it, and sometimes they were less likely to use protection, sometimes they were more likely to get pregnant or have STIs. So as far as...
But they're also more likely to, like, have oral sex, or...
I don't know about that.
Okay.
But, you know, I think that, for me, the important things about teenagers not having sex is that they don't have these life-altering things that could kill them or change the course of their adult lives. So, to me, abstinence-only education then is pointless because it doesn't do those things.
Right.
But the main reason that study had interested me that I thought no one talked about is that these were girls, and I didn't read the whole study because you have to pay for it, and I don't pay for things. But it was, you know, 12 and 13-year-old girls who were in a group where they talked about and did activities around their value as girls every day and how they should not have sex because they have, you know, because they have all these good things.
Right. So,
they, you know,
do you think that if that kind of social setting wasn't in place, that it would be a lot less effective?
Yeah, I mean, the other studies that found that teenagers delay sex with abstinence-only education found that it's especially true if there's a real strong group identity. So right. You have a group that really strongly identifies as Christian, then they are, and it's a large enough group to hold each other accountable, then they probably will have sex later. And so I kind of thought that must have had some role in explaining what was going on with these girls. They were all the same age and from the same areas, and you know, they sat around and talked about how their, girl power kind of stuff. I kind of feel like any situation in which 12 or 13-year-old girls are, that's what they concentrate on doing for any period of time of day, they're going to delay riskier behavior of all kinds because they're sitting around and talking about how great they are, and that has to be really affirming and great. And, you know, what chance do 12 and 13-year-old girls have to do that in their normal lives? Probably none, because being 13 sucks. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, to me, it seems that that's the bigger lesson to take from it, that these kind of really, like, self-affirming things for girls who are really on the edge are valuable, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I think it's a really great point.
But I kind of felt like that's what no one really talked about with the study. But also, with that study, the girls delayed sex, only like 9% of the... It was a 9% point difference between the girls who delayed sex and the girls who had sex earlier when they compared it to the comprehensive sex ed group. So it wasn't a huge difference in the number of girls who were waiting a long time.
What are the larger political implications of this? I mean, obviously, like you said, no Republican senators voted for the healthcare bill, so...
I think this is one of those things that, like, probably for most Democrats isn't really that big of a deal electorally, right? Like, they'll go to their districts, go to their states and say, I voted to do X, 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 and, I support abstinence-only education in my district. But that's probably actually a political winner for a lot of Democrats. I think, insofar that it's a political problem, it's a political problem for the administration as it tries to maintain a relationship with the Democratic Party of the left, with which it already has a strained relationship. I think this is ridiculous, but I am also, a sellout or something. But yeah,
realist.
I'm a realist. I think that's where will be a problem. That the Obama administration already is on shaky ground with much of the party activist class, and significant parts of the party base, and they won't like it. They won't like the fact that the Obama administration has willingly allowed abstinence-only education to get refunded. So,
yeah, it's money that we probably shouldn't be spending, and it's just really counter to the other programs that exist. So I don't know how practically it'll happen. You know?
Yeah.
If at the same time Obama's funding comprehensive sex ed,
is it flexible? Right? Can you if you are a state, can you say, can you take this money and do you have to do like strictly abstinence only, or can you do like abstinence plus, which is like a fusion of the two approaches? It seems like this is probably like a pretty flexible thing for most states, and they don't have to. Because the problem with a lot of abstinence-only programs is that it's not so much that they're saying, hey, kids, don't have sex until you're, older or married. It's that they say, don't have sex until you're older or married, and also we're not going to tell you about contraception, and we're going to try to reinforce, quote-unquote traditional gender roles.
Yeah, and that's actually, also what the critics say is actually this funding, I believe, would force programs to stick with the 5 or 8-point plan. I don't remember how many points it is, but it's pretty scripted. They can't talk about the things not in the plan, and they can't just say delay until you're ready. They have to say delay until marriage. And so a lot of people have pointed out that successful study group, that program would not have gotten funding because it didn't tell the girls to wait until they were married.
Huh.
And so it's really strict, but I think that because states have to match it, they don't have to take the money.
Okay.
And so they just would miss out on this pot of money.
It seems like it's just keeping the status quo. The states that want to do it will do it anyway.
I think that's true. I mean, when you grow up in a place where people believe in abstinence-only funding, it kind of doesn't matter what the national programs say you should talk about. They're not going to talk about condoms.
Right. Have any of you, either of you, had any abstinence-only education as...
I don't recall ever being told about contraception. But there wasn't... I don't really recall either being told that... You know, it wasn't like Mean Girls. You have sex and you die.
I had comprehensive sex ed through my church because I went through a really liberal church in the South, and actually that's where liberals dwell, is actually within the church. You can't be, like, an atheist in the South. In the Deep South, in the Bible Belt. But we had health in school, and my health teacher was a coach, and he told us that condoms have microscopic holes that AIDS can pass through. So it wasn't good sex ed. And everybody was pregnant before they were 19.
It was because of the microscopic holes in the condoms, though.
I know.
Your coach is absolutely correct in that case. You know, the kids use condoms, and then...
Oh, but it's a sieve! So, this is where I kind of out myself. I mean, y'all know. I was raised Catholic, and I was in this organization that we went around telling kids to wait until they got married. And it's funny because we used to go around and we get these little talks to like church groups or whatever. And it was like actively premised on a bunch of misinformation. Like it was like condoms are really ineffective. Like you just said, Monica, like it's very, you know, it was part of it was a big part of it was just scare tactics. Like, you know, you're going to get pregnant if you have sex. And we started saying that, like, you know, condoms, you know, they tell you that condoms are 90-something% effective, but that's only if you use them properly. Well, then, you know, as an adult, I'm like, well, teach people how to fucking use them properly. But, you know.
Can you tell everybody the name of the group that you were part of?
I refuse. No, okay, it was called CORT, which stood for Chaste Outstanding Urban Righteous Teens. Which, you know what? Fucking, I ain't got no shame. But I should just as an aside, and I've been meaning to blog about this, the person who ran this organization, he was defrocked because he was, well, this isn't funny, but he was defrocked because he was, he had had like a 2-decade history of molestation of young teenage boys. Anyway.
In the Catholic Church,
I know. I'm shocked. I know. Can you believe that? It's hard to wrap your mind around it. Anyway, we should move on to the next topic, since we're talking about teenagers. We should talk about something, and Monica didn't get this because she's not really part of the tribe, but Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a piece about not being black enough, or this phenomenon not being black enough, to which Jamel responded that the whole acting white thing had everything to do with kind of cultural competency and capital, which is a point that I've been making kind of offline a lot in conversations, because I think there's a real vested interest from a lot of people, including a lot of black people, in the idea that like black people, that acting white is about underachieving academically, overachieving academically, and that black people have this like pathology in which they actively demonize good school performance, which I think is kind of obviously horseshit. I think what really happens is that people are ostracized for any number of reasons that have a lot to do with who they associate with. We know that black kids in integrated environments are less likely to be placed in AP classes and stuff like that. So what I'm pretty sure happens is that those black kids who do excel academically are more likely to be put in AP classes in which they're a distinct minority. And so they end up spending a lot of their social time as teenagers with white kids. And so the black kids who are also disproportionately more likely to be in remedial classes see them as kind of sellouts or whatever. But that's not because of their achievement. That's because of something else entirely. It's about the way we stratify and treat black kids. But I also think it's also just about, like, nerdiness. Like, I think, I mean, a lot of people are like, oh, they called me, they said I was acting white because I spoke properly and because I did well in school. Well, besides the fact that speaking properly is a really problematic term, right? I think people said that shit because you were corny and you wore fucking high waters and you
exactly,
said third eye blind or whatever.
That's exactly the case, you know? Like, I got the acting white charge in high school and middle school, but honestly, it's because I was a nerd. Like, I had glasses and braces, and, you know, in high school, I was in student government and everything, and listened to punk rock, and so it's like, I had zero cultural capital with a lot of black kids.
Right.
And, well, it sucked. I was not very happy about that. You know, it's sort of, I didn't fit in with them, and I, you know, judging from, like, my cultural consumption and what I did in school, like, I, you know, was, I gravitated to, like, the white kids at school. You're acting white.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think what's problematic in that charge also is that I do think a lot of black kids have a particular vision of what it means to be black.
Absolutely.
And it has nothing to do with academic. It has to do with, like, you know, your cultural capital. Like, if you don't listen to a certain kind of music, if you don't dress a certain way, then you aren't black, which is not true.
Right, of course. This is the point that I keep trying to make, is that, like, that is fucked up. It's problematic, and it needs to be challenged, and we need to obviously push at, I mean, this, we try to do this all the time on the blog, but push for, like, this really, really broad understanding of whatever blackness is, you know, without trying to define it so narrowly. But at the same time, that's fundamentally different. Saying someone is acting white because they're socially awkward is different and has completely different implications than saying someone is acting white because they do well in school. And I just don't buy that argument that happens. Like, I think one of the reasons that people cling, black people especially, cling to the idea that acting white has a lot to do with academic achievement is that they have to, like, couch their ostracism, their adolescent ostracism, in this way that makes them kind of like heroes, you know? Like, I was so willing to achieve that these motherfuckers couldn't handle it. You know what I mean? It's just really, really frustrating because it has huge implications. I mean, Barack Obama went on when he was running for president, slid that into a speech, you know, and a few people called it his sister soldier moment or whatever, but he slid it into one of those church speeches when he was at a black church. And, you know, we can't have kids feeling like they're acting white if they decide that they want to do well in school. But the reality is, that's not, like, this idea is kind of, it's a myth that cannot, is, like, hard to kill, because a lot of white people want to hear it, and a lot of black people who want to feel as if they're even more worthy of praise for whatever their achievements may be, they want to feel like doing so was, like, culturally risky. You know what I mean?
Right.
I was going to give Obama a pass a bit because he would have just heard that from other people, right? He didn't...
Right, I mean, it's kind of hard to say, right? Like, whether he felt it... I went to an all-black high school that was in Philadelphia that was academically selective. Well, not all-black, but it was 85 or so percent black. I mean, there were 60-70 kids in my graduating class, and 140 of them were black. So it was like 75% plus or 80% plus or whatever. That charge of acting white just never got really bandied about a lot. One, because there weren't a lot of white kids around to begin with, but also, like, they're just being academically, just being an academic standout wasn't a big fucking deal.
Right.
But I don't think that pressure is ever about academic excellence. Again, I think it's about the out-group thing. And I think it's really telling, personally, I mean, this is my personal experience, obviously, but in an environment in which there isn't this whole in-group, out-group dynamic necessarily, or this particular one anyway, then that charge doesn't get bandied about as much. And the kids who were, and there were kids who got called acting white, but in that context, again, it was because they didn't speak like kids from inner city Philadelphia. You know what I mean? Like, they spoke a certain way. And again, that's fucking problematic, but it's not the same thing as saying that they were acting white because they did well in school.
Yeah, I also just want to clarify my Barack Obama statement, because I meant that it sounds like the kind of thing that he would have picked up as a Chicago politician, because
right.
It kind of sounds like the thing Chicago politicians would say. It doesn't sound like the kind of thing that he would have... thought before that necessary. Do you know what I mean?
Like, right, well, I wonder, I mean, I don't know, but I wonder, just because he would have been one of those people who is moving in, moving
oh, yeah, yeah,
in,
yeah.
Like, in, like, whiter worlds.
Especially, like, in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the commenters on my post, and I think Rape and Justin, made the really good point that you oftentimes will see the charge brandied by white kids who also have a particular vision of what black kids should be. And, you know, if you don't fit that, then you're acting white. To them, you're acting white, too. The problem, I mean, again, yeah, the problem it has nothing to do with academics, it's something to do with that there's this image of blackness that is really narrow and that lots of people buy into, and that if you veer from it, you're ostracized. But that's the case with lots of things. Like, this isn't unique. Like, that's for every time there's a default or a certain standard, the people who deviate are ostracized or shunned. I mean, I would just prefer if everyone's understood the acting white thing as just another category of that.
Absolutely.
And that is some unique, you know, black pathology.
There's this book by this I think he's a Yale Law grad. He went to either Yale Law or Harvard Law, called Acting White. That's coming out very soon, if it's not already, about... He writes about, like, how integration... He's a white guy. He wrote about how... He's writing about how integration created this environment in which black academic excellence was, like, frowned upon by black people. And I'm obviously really skeptical of this idea, and I want to read the book before I, like, tear it to shreds or to see what he's talking about. But one of the things that... And maybe I'm getting stuck on his bio is that he adopted two black boys. And I guess they had those charges, like, leveled against them, that they weren't sufficiently black. And, again, I think, like, just off the top line reading of this, like, one of the reasons they may have been branded insufficiently black is because their father was fucking white, you know what I mean? But, like,
yeah, I was just gonna say that. I was like, wait, didn't you just say their father was white? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Seemed to be the thing to point to.
Right, and this is the thing that keeps annoying me, is that, like, whenever people bring this argument up, is that it seems like there are much more obvious reasons why someone would make that charge. You know what I mean? It's like, the fact that you are rocking, you dress cornily, and that's obviously just fucked up and whatever, but the fact that you carry yourself a certain way, or maybe you speak a certain way that is not acceptably black, is the problem. It's not the academic part. And you could argue that, you know, I guess in the larger sense, that integration made it so that there was less of a mix of like economic classes among black people in close proximity, but then you have to fucking make the argument that segregation was a good thing, which is not a place you want to go.
Right. I know lots of older black people who will kind of begin to move in that direction, and I'm always never talking about it. My first thing is, like, you know, for all the unintended and maybe negative effects of integration, it's hard to deny that, like, on the whole, integration's been very good, and segregation was not actually that great, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I think people think of segregation as just, like, oh, the days of Jim Crow, as this time when black people just couldn't pee where they didn't want to pee, as if, like, segregation wasn't this, like, massive fetter on black wealth creation. You know, I was reading The Race Beat and just reading about the kind of stuff that John Lewis went through with doing the Freedom Rides and all this other stuff. It's just, like, I think people have this very sanitized idea of, like, what it meant to be separate.
Right.
No, I think also, I think the people who kind of, like, get nostalgic over the things that segregation was good about also forget that, like, segregation was good for black institutions as opposed to, like, individuals.
Oh,
do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Absolutely.
You know, and so it's like that gets conflated in ways that are dangerous.
Absolutely. Let's go to shout-outs. Jamel, you want to start?
Sure. I will shout out not the iPad, but iPhone OS 4, which was unveiled today. So I really like my iPhone. It's revolutionized the way I use the internet and the bathroom.
Is that true for you, Monica? You have an iPhone too? Do you drop a deuce and handle business?
It is true that I don't let the iPhone go. I'll just say that.
But there's been a lot of, you know, the iPhone's missing a lot of features that other smartphones, various and Android have. For instance, there's terrible. It manages push notifications terribly. You just get, like, a bunch of them, and you can't really sort through them unless you buy a separate app or something. There's no multitasking, which With the 3GS isn't as much of a problem because everything's so fast, but on older models, it's definitely a major drag. There, you can't do folders full of apps, which really limits the number of apps you can have on a single phone. You can't do multiple exchange, you can't do like more than one exchange account at a time, which is like little things that really, for a power user, kind of become limiting and lead people to jailbreak. So OS 4 kind of corrects for all of these and adds a bunch of new stuff. And so I've been keeping up with the news. I'm really excited. I can get new software for my iPhone this summer, which will hold me over until I get a new iPhone next year.
So let me just complain real quick. My Verizon contract is up when I was going to get an iPhone, and I was like, finally, I'm going to get an iPhone. And Shani was like, no, she had a BlackBerry. She's like, get a BlackBerry. So I sold out, got a BlackBerry. Shani has an iPhone now.
Yeah.
She just she got an iPhone through her job, and now she uses that all the time. And I'm stuck here with this fucking BlackBerry when I want an iPhone.
I'm just going to say, for the way that you use your phone, your BlackBerry is better. Because, well, like, I have an older model iPhone, and it is really annoying. Like, I can't stay signed in to chat and do anything. Mm-hmm. So, when I didn't have internet for a while, I was just always, like, if I wanted to be online, I just had to sit there and be online without doing anything else on my phone.
Well, that doesn't make me feel better, because your phone is pretty.
And it also, the battery dies really fast.
That's true.
I have a 3GS, and it's in settings tweaking, so you can, like, keep the battery going longer, and, you know, I think the iPhone, much like the iPad, and I think the iPad will work the same way, even if you say to yourself, I only use my phone for texting or messaging and email, because of the App Store, you end up using your phone for other things that you wouldn't imagine using it for, because it's available. So, like, my phone has basically replaced my Nintendo DS, which is a signal to the crowd that I am indeed a huge nerd.
Right, as if we didn't know that before.
I was going to say, I feel like I need to remind people repeatedly that, hey, I'm probably the nerdiest person at Post Bougie.
I'm pretty sure you snorted sometime at this podcast.
I think I did. I think I snorted, yeah.
But we should belabor the point, though.
I actually really do want an iPad because I don't like all these people who say it doesn't form a purpose because those are the people who, like, the early adopters who also have a Mac desktop and a Mac laptop. And yeah. I'm like, yes, it does not serve a purpose for you. You should not have bought it. But I want one because I have a desktop. And the iPhone is really good for a lot of things, but it's not good for, it has its limitations as an entertainment device, which is what I use it for on my 4-hour bus trips.
It would seem like it would be kind of uncomfortable to hold.
It seems to not be a device for writing.
Which is what we all do.
Yeah. It's a device for, like, consuming.
Yeah.
Which I'm totally for. But it looks like a fantastic ebook reader. Like, I was never, ever in my life going to ever buy an ebook reader because I like books. And, like, I don't want to read them on a black and white screen. And I don't understand paying, like, $400 for an app for something that just does one thing. But, like, the iPad does a lot of things, and among those things is help you read books. So, you know, I think it'll really kill the other things.
This segment of the Post Bougie podcast is brought to you by Apple. Monica, do you have a shout out?
Do I have a shout out? I don't have a shout out. I was trying to think of what I wanted to endorse.
You want to shout down?
You know what? I'm gonna shout out. I'm gonna shout out this peanut sauce that I've made forever. It's really easy, and it's just like peanut butter and a bunch of other things that you would have in your pantry if you cook it all. And it's really delicious if you're just making like vegetables. Just to pour the peanut sauce over the vegetables and rice, and it's like the easiest dinner, and it makes it taste really good, and it has a lot of protein. I'm gonna endorse peanut sauce.
I can't believe that was your real endorsement.
Always.
I'm gonna shout out. So at PB we have this little cadre of really, really talented writers. But my good friend Stacia, who I've been friends with for a long time, Stacia, who blogs as SLP79 and does a lot of the book and culture blogging at PB, is also by far the finest writer that I know. She's been writing on her blog about her personal blog about her pregnancy, and you know someone for a long time, you kind of take it for granted that this is thing they do and they do it well, but then you kind of see them doing it and you kind of are floored at how well they do it. She's a stunning writer. She's been writing about this process of being pregnant and the relationship with the father of the child and all this other stuff, and it's a really personal kind of intense stuff. I mean, it's just phenomenal writing. So if you can, we'll link to it on the podcast page, but you should definitely give it a look. I think that's it. Anybody else got anything to say?
No,
but thanks for asking.
See, I'm Shani's being gracious this week. All right, so on behalf of Jamel in Charlottesville and Monica in DC, this is GD. Be easy.
Our theme music is 8 by Aeon. You can catch us at postbougie.com.